Hello and welcome to Rain City Bunker. This is episode 35. I am your host, co-host, Greg Moon, and I'm here with my friend and co-host, Andy Brown.
That's me.
So, Andy, we're living in crazy times, so
yeah,
we decided to do a podcast about it.
Yeah, we're kind of truly bunkerized now.
The whole country.
Yeah. So, kind of the reason Greg and I talked about this, kind of the reason we thought to do it is because, although I think everybody's going to catch up to us sooner or later, Seattle was one of the first places that got hit by the whole Corona COVID-19. Am I getting that right, Greg? COVID-19?
Yep, that's the kind of like the popular name. It's not the scientific name.
Yeah. So the coronavirus. Yeah, try not to freak out. I think, Greg, you're probably a little bit more calm about it than I am.
I think we're both on the cautious side. We had a conversation last night. I think you're being a little more cautious, which I do not fault you for. You're probably being the smarter of the two.
No, I've just seen too many zombie movies.
Oh, and want to let the audience know, we are doing something new tonight. We are broadcasting per the new reality. We are recording this on Skype, and Skype has a built-in tool to record, and Andy gave me his permission to record him, and we are recording on Skype. So you may hear more electronic noises than you're used to on our podcast, and it's our first time, so presumably it will get better as we go along.
Social distancing, folks. Social distancing.
Yes, yes. So we're about 20 miles from each other, so I think we're pretty safe.
Yeah. There are those computer viruses, though. And a friend who was working as an intern for a company, he was in their computer department. He grew up with computers. And he said that he actually got a call. He was essentially help desk. And he got a call from a woman who was wondering if she could catch a computer virus.
Yeah. I think there's probably a book or two out there about funny IT support questions.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right, man. So, yeah, it's a different world. I've been working from home.
I was just going to ask about your life. So let's talk about Andy's life first.
Well, that started on Wednesday. Up until Wednesday, I was going into work every day. And
so we are recording on a Monday. So that was just this last Wednesday, right?
Yes, correct. Okay. Yeah. So since Wednesday, the streets started thinning out, a lot of people kind of maintaining distance from each other. Not a lot of the mask wearing, but I did see more of that. Yeah, and we still don't know, Greg and I talked about this last night. It's still, to us, it's still kind of unclear whether, hospital people need masks. I'm going to look for some that I got surplus like years ago to see if I can donate. So they're the primary people that need them. We kind of went back and forth on whether actually wearing a mask just when you're out and about in this kind of situation does anything. And you found some statistics that show that where was it? Korea that people.
Yeah, I think it was Korea, Hong Kong, and Singapore. It's culturally acceptable to wear masks, and they do.
Yeah.
And I showed Andy a chart, and we couldn't verify the data, but a chart of the growth. And those countries have the lowest growth of the COVID-19 disease, and they wear masks.
Yeah.
So, it kind of suggests a correlation. Causation and correlation, of course, there's a whole discussion there. But and to me, and Andy and I agreed, we've heard – that you should not use masks. And we kind of think that's because there's been a shortage.
Right.
And the medical professionals should be the ones, they're working very closely with people. So they need to be protected more than anyone. But, why don't you continue talking about your life? Is there anything about how your life has changed?
Well, it's just what I don't like is uncertainty. you know, that there's this kind of a sense of powerlessness to it. I don't feel like I can really do anything to affect anything. One piece of, I don't know if this would make people more anxious or less anxious, but one thing that I posted on Facebook that I do daily is I take my temperature, and that reassures me. It hasn't gone high. It's always landed. Here's the weird thing, Greg. Now I have something, when this is all over, I have something else to worry about. My temperature is routinely coming in at around 96.
A little low, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's a little low. I don't know why. I don't think that's remarkably abnormal, but like when doctors are a little bit more freed up, if there's any of them left after this whole thing, I'm probably going to ask about that. You know, I am using one of those. I couldn't find the digital thermometer. I'm sure I'll find it in a box like 5 years from now. But so the only ones that were around were the glass ones with the it doesn't have mercury. It's some other thing in it.
Yeah. You know what? I mean, I don't know, but I just feel like the old fashioned ones would be more accurate, but I don't know. I took my temperature the other day too. And it was something like 96.9 or something. I think, and you said the average is 98.6.
No, that's like, average. That's the average temperature, right?
Average, but healthy.
Yeah. Healthy human temperature. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so how is your mate doing?
Oh, good. I mean, she, you know, it was weird.
Has her life changed?
What's strange, she actually had an accreditation course that she was taking for the job that she does. And it was a video. It was a video course. So webinar? she was already set up to kind of work from home during the week anyways. She's hanging in there. We're trying to distract ourselves. We're following kind of a regimen of social distancing, and we're going with the glove method, where we have these nitrile, I think that's what it is, these nitrile gloves that we put on, and then we have some alcohol. I managed to score some, like a couple big bottles of rubbing alcohol, and we spray those down. Like if we go out before we touch anything, we spray those down, and you kind of, you know, rub your hands like you're washing your hands. That seems to be pretty good. I actually, as this was all happening, I couldn't believe I got it, but I ordered a little handheld UVC, which is ultraviolet light, and it's in the C wavelength.
And it kills viruses,
It kills pretty much everything. It kills bacteria. It kills, you know, viruses and stuff like that. And it's not good for, you know, prolonged skin exposure. So I don't really use it on my skin. I use it on objects and stuff like that. And it's UVC. I didn't know this before. There's ultraviolet, like when you think of like at a rave or something like that. That's a different wavelength. I think that's B or A. At any rate. And then there's like the tanning booth, which, by the way, I believe like the tanning booth wavelength, I think that actually has some disinfecting qualities to it too. But as we know, if you get exposed to it too much, you know, it's not good for you. So.
Yeah. So when and where do you use your light?
We are still, because we need something, like, I don't know how much longer this is going to be, but we'll go to like maybe Starbucks, right? And they have the drive-thru. And so like everything that the person touches, we first handle with our gloves, and then disinfect the gloves, and then I use the wand and everything, which is probably somewhat overkill, but
the wand is the light.
Yeah, the wand is the light. Yes.
Okay, great. Okay.
Here's a little interesting thing about this, you know, since I know you like science. So UVC is produced by the sun, but it's blocked by our atmosphere. It doesn't actually reach us, and it's only produced by mercury lamps. Oh. And welding, arc welding torches.
That is interesting. Yeah. Well, yeah. if it did get through our atmosphere, the first living things would have never happened, so we wouldn't be here probably. Right,
exactly.
Or we'd be a lot different.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you about a little bit about my life and how it's changed a little bit. We have two younger kids at home. So we have a first grader and an eighth grader. And I think it's the hardest thing for them. I believe the eighth grader has the hardest time because she's just gotten some new friends and she wants to go out with them. And her mom is a little more cautious than I am and is not letting her go. So she's kind of stuck. But, you know, if this had happened like 25 years ago, it would have been a little tougher with no internet, no chatting, no video. So we have all this entertainment available to us. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. But I think it is hardest on her.
Yeah.
And the little one, I'm taking the lead on kind of like teaching her things. So, and I only do one lesson a day.
Yeah.
Math, reading, science. Yeah, go ahead.
Do they have lesson plans that you got through the school?
Not really, because, you know, they really weren't ready. This happened kind of suddenly. I don't think anyone planned for this.
Yeah.
So, there are some lesson suggestion plans for the eighth grader, and I've yet to persuade her to participate. But with the little one, you know, I can take charge a little more.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, so we're doing science and reading and a little bit of math.
You know, as long as they're into it, as long as she's into it, I really honestly, I mean, let me put it this way. How much do you really remember? Like, do you really think back to when you were a kid, right? Mm-hmm. And let's say you had to be out of the game for a while. As long as every other kid is on the same page, I don't really see how much damage that really does.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. But I think it's a good idea just to kind of kill some time. But
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes.
If she's into it, even better.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So, and so, you know, there's no school. I wasn't working anyway, so it kind of worked out because, you know, my wife probably likes to have me around. I help out quite a bit. And, you know, so no going out. And, you know, I'm fairly social, so I would see friends once a week, maybe a little less. But, you know, go to a bar, go to a restaurant. That's all closed, of course. I attend church services almost every Sunday, so that's over.
Yeah.
And
well, you said they did they do the online thing?
Yeah. But they recorded it. It wasn't like streaming. But still, it was interesting, but nowhere near as fun for me, you know, interacting with people. Yeah. And so, you know, it's just like you said, it's a new reality. But we know it's temporary, you know. It may be 3 months, 4 months, but you know, this probably, I don't think anyone would even, I think people would just go ahead and commit suicide after a year. So I doubt it'll make a year, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting. And my wife's a little more concerned than I am. Like, we went shopping, speaking of masks.
Yeah.
We went shopping today, and she's been upset me a couple times because I'll go pick up bread or something. So I'm trying to cut back on that. I make impromptu runs to the store. So that's being cut back. But she wore gloves like you and a mask.
Oh, wow.
And we, you know, we shop at the Asian market. I'm not sure Asian Americans are any more higher rate than anyone else. I doubt it at this point.
Yeah, I doubt it.
But,
yeah.
But she is very, why, she's very why, aware
I'm,
of it.
I'm not trying to set you up, but why would you even think that? Like,
because, you know, we've been going to this market, and well before anyone else was concerned, they had their workers in the coronavirus masks.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Before any of us even cared.
Yeah.
Because it's Asian, but it's predominantly Chinese owned or run or something. Oh, so,
right.
Yeah, they jumped on it quickly.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
So, I went in. I didn't wear a mask or gloves. But I tried not to touch anything. And I carry hand sanitizer in my car. So I sanitized my hands as soon as I got in the car. So I'm not as cautious as some other people. Oh, and another thing, today, walking the dog, I encountered a lady, an older lady, and I was kind of keeping my distance. She said, "Oh, can we talk?" You know, she thought I was trying to avoid her, and you know, I said, "Oh yeah, we can talk." And so we talked, and she was a real sweet old lady, and you know, elderly people are the most at risk.
Yeah.
But we kept about, I stayed about 10 feet away from her, and she stayed away from me too.
Yeah.
And we had a pleasant talk, and
nice.
Sounds like she has a couple kids nearby, and she's not lonely. But
yeah,
it was a interesting. People feel, you know, usually you wouldn't ask that. Can we talk? You know, you just say hi. But you know, when someone's walking like 20 feet around you, like so it's an odd, kind of odd situation.
Yeah.
But there it is.
I've kind of found that I'm talking more with just being pleasant to neighbors and everything, and just, you know, not, you know, obviously keeping the distance and so forth, but just, you know, saying hello. And I mean, I always do anyways, but I'm kind of making an effort. Well, we had a little bit of a snafu. We were recording yesterday, and we lost each other. I think it ended up being, it was still recording, but Greg couldn't hear me anymore, and I could hear him, and then I lost him completely. He's taken some steps, I believe, to ensure that won't happen, or will be less chance of happening. Like you're
it could happen, but we'll just be more diligent about actually recording our response afterwards. I need a new router. I have an old cheap router, so I need to buy a heavy duty router. And we have a lot of traffic at home now, you know.
Yeah.
Wife, kids, blah blah blah.
Did you plug in directly?
No, I did not do that either. But I think we're gonna be fine.
We'll cross our fingers. But we remembered we let off, which was, I was just talking about just being generally friendlier, and yesterday was the night before our trash recycle and composting pickup, which they're still doing, thank God. And I was about to tell Greg that I was gonna leave a note thanking the the guys who do that. Or the folks who do that. And I was just too, by the time I put everything out, I was just too tired and I didn't do it, but I did take the dog for a walk and I did see the guy doing the recycling and chatted with him and, you know, and from a safe distance yelled my thanks to him. And it's funny, there was an older woman who came out of her house and said the same thing. And I think I'd like to think that made his day a little bit better. I've just been trying to do stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, kind of in that broader theme. I think people are trying to be a little friendlier. I notice when I go to restaurants, people say thanks, and it's just like, you know, we feel like we're in the kind of like the foxhole together. Right.
Right.
We're trying to support one another, I think. And I usually say, gee, how's business? Cause you know, I'm not sure if I mentioned, but I'm delivering right now.
Yeah.
And I come across people and, you know, we keep our distance. I wore gloves today, Andy. Your suggestion was very good. And but, you know, I say, oh, I hope you guys are doing good. And they say, oh, we're doing OK. Most people say they're doing OK. Some people sound like they're just holding on. You know, if you can, you know, I've heard this a lot on the radio. Support your local businesses that are still open. They need your help.
One thing that somebody mentioned is you could always get a gift certificate from your favorite restaurant.
Yeah, to help them keep going for the interim, right?
Yeah.
Give them a cash flow.
I think that's a good idea. We have kind of rehearsal because we kept talking after the snafu. I think what the next thing we talked about was we were going to talk a little bit about the virus itself and our unscientific.
Semi-scientific, I'd say. Yeah, I mean, some of our stuff goes into pseudoscientific, but, you know, with this, we want to be as accurate as possible.
Right.
You know, the thing, it's hard to be accurate right now because we're still learning so much about it. It's only been around for like 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
But from what we do right now is first of all, my pet peeve, and I think Andy's yours as well, is people are saying, oh, it's just like the flu, and it could possibly end up that way, but right now it does not look that way. It looks nearly twice as transmissible. for one thing, which makes it a little more scary, right? By itself, you know. You know how easy it is to get a flu, but imagine this is twice as easy to get this, COVID-19. And also, you know, based early statistics, but it does look like there's 10 times as many hospitalizations.
Yeah.
And there's 10 times as many fatalities. So when you do all the math, that's a lot more than the flu. A lot more people going to the hospital, a lot more people dying. So at this point, I don't think we really should be saying it's like the flu. It's a lot worse. And I think, you know, a lot of this crazy stuff we're doing, it, no one likes it, but it looks like the smart thing to do at this point.
Yeah. And I just think testing is the key. It's the key.
Totally agree. And Andy, just from last night, I've been reading about it. If those keeping the eye on our statistics, America's cases are like near Italy's cases now.
Yeah.
And it's good news and bad news. It's bad news that people are sick, but it's good news. We're testing like crazy. Well, not like crazy. We're getting there. So, we're behind the curve on the testing, but we're slowly getting where we need to be, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, I was talking, I don't think we had in, we had brought up Jeanette, our friend who's the geneticist, in the prior half hour, but we did later on, and we'll do it again. But I was communicating with her as well. And, you know, one of the things she kind of confirmed, an idea that I was thinking of as well, which another advantage to testing is hurting those people that, and I shouldn't say hurting because that sounds like hurting, getting those people tested that may be asymptomatic, you know, or
that's
maybe
the,
just
in fact, that's one of the big bugaboos about this thing.
Right.
Asymptomatic people are out there wandering around infecting other people.
But the other aspect of that, if you think about it, is it's a little bit more, the test to see if the virus is still in the system is a little bit more complicated. And I think that is a blood draw, but even if you could just get the less expensive, more common test, these people who are asymptomatic could find out, they could sequester themselves for the 14 days. And then when they're done, these are people that can enter into the workforce. They can enter into, you know, the back into the hospitals. They can do that because they have gone through it. Their immunity is present.
But isn't there still a risk they could get it, even if they've already had it?
I don't. You know, I've read varying things, but I don't think so. And I know, you know, I think they're less likely to get it again. And I do know that is what's happening. I mean, that people, I know of at least one person that I'm familiar with that was part of it, was in the hospital that had some of the Seattle's first cases. They were positive. They actually did get a little sick, not horribly sick. And then they're back at their job. So, but I just, testing is where it's at. It's testing.
Yeah.
And then she sent me another interesting thing, which is this new kind of vaccine. The article she sent me was 2015, and it was something that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is involved in. And it's essentially an RNA instead of a DNA. It's an RNA vaccine. And I don't know enough to describe it completely, but it's we can put a link on our various things, or you can look up RNA vaccination. It's easier to produce, it's cheaper to produce, and it's more effective. It looks like it's more effective against these kind of novel viral outbreaks that may drift and may mutate, whereas sometimes the more traditional old way of doing it, or, you know, current way of doing it, it's more specific, and the vaccine might kind of miss its target. And you can develop this vaccine a little bit more rapidly.
Aren't they already testing some, or they've, I think I've heard of two or three And the testing is what takes the time and the effort. But with this current situation, they may be expediting some of the testing.
Yeah,
exactly. On the vaccines.
Yeah, I hope so. I think they're going as fast as they can, you know. But
yeah, I think this was the fastest sequenced new virus or, you know, disease. I mean, the technology is getting better, obviously, all the time.
Yes, yeah.
So that's why South Korea was so able to get their tests quickly, because they got sequenced so quickly and they had the code, basically.
Yeah. You know,
the biological code needed to create the test.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Yeah. A quick follow-up, Andy. Today I heard a radio news or story or something. I forget where it was. Might have been Como. I listen to Como sometimes on a local radio station here. And they were talking about that the Koreans did indeed use cellular telephone technology to track people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And so if someone was quarantined, they use this example on the radio show. So if someone was like, you know, identified to have it, supposed to stay home, but they could see they were moving because of the cell phone data, because cell phones collect GPS data too.
Oh, yeah.
Can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they would notify people that came close to the person that got out. I mean, so they're using technology in a very sophisticated way that might make a lot of Americans a little nervous. But anyway, that's part of the way they're doing it, is tracking the people.
Yeah, I don't
along
think
with
that,
the extensive testing, of course.
I don't think that's going to come into play, because I, you know, just getting that sort of thing through the political process is not going to happen anytime quickly.
In America.
But once again, testing I can't say that enough. I think that's where it's at.
And this is kind of cheek, but so say you test positive, should they put like a semi-permanent red stamp on someplace?
You mean
since we can't track their cell phone, right? Maybe you could just stamp them like, oh yeah, and put the date on. So,
well,
a scarlet letter of sorts.
The thing you don't want with Americans is people opting out because they're afraid of that kind of stuff. So. Once again, I think it's just, but there should be, like, you know, obviously a database, you know, would have to be created. And but here's how I think you would reward people, right? And this is, and, you know, this is the, if you test positive, you can kind of be cleared after your sequestration period. This is how I was thinking of it. So you could kind of be officially cleared. So you could go to like your boss and be like, I can go back to work because I've had it and I've gone through it. And here's my official, you know, from the, you know, the government or whatever, the state says I'm good to go back in, you know.
They're probably mostly immune. That's like we're not quite clear on that. But
yeah,
I mean, even if it's a little tricky, but. Yeah, I would think that, you know, if someone lived through it and they're okay, they should have antibodies.
Yeah.
Right. For that particular virus.
Right. And I think, you know, I kind of think, too, that, like, the greater percentage is that you aren't going to, you know, go through whatever version of the virus is in your locality and then get the other one that may, you know what I mean? I think that's probably the best way to go.
Yeah. So, you know, a question that came up with talking to another friend of mine was like, and I think you touched on this, Andy. Can we possibly eradicate this, like smallpox or the measles or something?
Yeah.
Or is this something that will stay with us year to year, like influenza? Influenza strains vary, right, by year a little bit, but that's basically influenza. So, you know.
Well, here's the thing. This is a novel COVID.
It's new.
It's new, but the various strains of the COVID virus, if I'm saying it's right, or the coronavirus, they have been out there and been with us and everything like that. So
SARS, MERS, and apparently the common cold.
Yeah. I think what this will do is create more kind of watchdog agencies and you know, kind of essentially like kind of virologists and more of an organized like scout for this. It better produce more openness between governments, because I think part of what caused this problem was, as we talked, as I think we talked about but didn't record, is, you know, the Chinese government, their first kind of instinct was to bury it, was to cover it up. And I think if they had maybe shared the data around the world, everybody could have responded to this.
I think China's reaction was kind of mixed. First reaction was like, I read an article that said, oh, the Chinese think it's not transmissible person to person. They said that early on.
Right.
But they did sequence it quickly. It was the Chinese who sequenced it, I believe.
Right.
And once they realized they couldn't control it, I think they did kind of start publishing the numbers. But we don't know everything they did. I don't think we know.
Well, I know there's rumors. I know there was.
It was a little rough on some of the people there.
Well, remember they arrested that doctor who was talking about it, and he eventually died from it.
Because he was on the front lines.
Yeah. And they arrested him. That's not real open. You know, that's
Not. But so you know, they did sequence it, which was an important piece of scientific work for everyone. And and I'm not defending them, but I'm just saying I think it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
You know.
I think what is required, and like what I was saying, is the lesson from this is openness.
You
have to be open from jump, you know, and I know I talked about this last night, so I'll stop saying that when we cover same things again. But it reminds me so much of the Chernobyl miniseries that was on HBO, and Chernobyl in reality, I would imagine, where it was a disaster, but it was exacerbated by the authorities thinking politically, and, you know, instead of thinking about, you know, trying to head off the disaster or trying to mitigate the disaster. And that's what this is kind of indicating to me as well, where I think the danger, you know, the disaster is going to happen, but what makes it worse is this authoritarian impulse. The impulse to make it more about politics than public health, and more about the government's how it might impact the government or your power. So, you know, hopefully that'll change. I don't know. Maybe that's just human nature and it won't. But that seems to be a story that has some precedent, you know.
Yeah, Andy, and as you mentioned when we were talking yesterday, Chernobyl was a similar sort of situation, and the Russians, the Soviets, tried to kind of hide it. They didn't admit what was going on, and was it the Swedes who detected the radiation, and then they had to come clean, right? Yeah, so it makes it more embarrassing in the end, actually, when you try to hide a big thing you can't hide.
Yeah, no, that's kind of how I think about it. I mean, that's why it's a bad idea to do it. It could be the end of, if you're an authoritarian government or you're a government that's flirting with that, this could bring it down, you know?
Yeah. And China's in a particularly interesting situation because they are highly dependent on a lot of the rest of the world nowadays, right? Because their economy is manufacturing, which is largely exports.
Right.
So they can't just do the Chernobyl thing. The Russians weren't as intertwined, right? The Chinese have to be a little more concerned about their perception, right? So, and I don't think their response was as bad as the Soviets with Chernobyl, but beginning, it had those same kind of inclinations, huh?
Yeah. So that might be a good segue into some of the conspiracy theories that came up, you know, and that we were talking about originally. And I know, Greg, you were at least, I have to say this, at least you were kind of aware of this and had some concern about it way back when. I'm trying to remember when you first kind of sent me like an email or a text or whatever about the coronavirus. And it was quite a while ago. It was at least January.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And, you know, it's partly, you know, we've mentioned this before. I'm more on the conservative side. Andy's more on the liberal side. But the conservatives were, they tend to be a little more anti-Chinese, I think, because they're communists. Yeah. And so, and not, obviously not, you just find more of it on the conservative side. But people were saying, oh, this is the Chinese. Well, first of all, the Wuhan, and I didn't look it up, but it's either a research lab, biological research lab, is right where that virus started, right?
Yeah.
And they say the first case was near the seafood market.
Right.
So, you know, some people were suggesting that, hey, this is an escaped or, you know, consciously launched virus.
Yeah.
And later on, I found some articles I sent along, and I think both of you and I are fairly skeptical. I sent along, hey, this is what I've seen. Right. And a couple of researchers had looked at the DNA sequence and thought, oh, that looks like HIV. There was a couple segments they thought looked a lot like HIV and some other one.
Yeah.
And they actually published the article, but you said you later read that that had been refuted, right?
Right. Well, these were legitimate researchers, legitimate scientists, apparently. But I do remember in the guy's original posting, he used some kind of pretty alarmist language. Since then, they published it, but it was not peer reviewed. And they have since, as I understand it, taken it down and disavowed it themselves, the mm-hmm. people who originally published it. Okay. And every serious scientist who I've read since then has said, no, this is everything about the genetic makeup of this virus indicates that it was something that arose out of nature. And as I understand it, they can actually kind of tell when something has been kind of lab grown because there's mm-hmm. certain markers, and this has none of those markers.
Yeah. And those pieces that look like HIV could have just are just naturally occurring.
Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
And HIV, well, it's kind of under control. It's still out there, but I don't think it's quite as deadly. I think it is deadly in the third world, you know, quote unquote third world. But in America, you can get HIV and live for years.
Just recently, I think like the second person in the world was cured of HIV. Oh. That was a news story that just came out recently. So that's very hopeful. And they used, I believe, gene therapy to do that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then they also have I think it's called PrEP, which is a prophylactic medicine that prevents people who are in high risk categories from contracting HIV. So it is something mm-hmm. that they are getting a handle on. But, you know, I mean, not like anybody's going to change their habits because of us, but, you know, obviously safe sex and so forth is the best way to
but the reason I bring that up is HIV isn't particularly transmit. It's hard to transmit, actually.
Yeah,
it's a tough one. You got to be it's intimate thing like needles and sex, right?
Yeah.
And it used to be deadly, but it's not so deadly anymore.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you're gonna make a bioweapon, I'm not sure HIV is the best thing to base your bioweapon on. Right.
There's a whole,
unless you're just experimenting and playing around.
But as a conspiracy theory, going viral, and you know, pun intended, but I'm talking about as a meme, there's a whole long history, including many conspiracy theories about HIV. So that's something that's in people's minds. That's kind of a trigger that would make this kind of a successful conspiracy. Yeah.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
But also you mentioned, on the part that we lost that, bioweapons are just not that smart in general because of the huge potential for blowback. And if the Chinese did it, guess who their first victims were?
Well, yeah. Well, that was my, you know, when Greg and I were talking about this several weeks ago, that was kind of my joke. I'm like, if this is a bioweapon that the Chinese have come up with, they should probably stop making bioweapons because it's really not doing them any favors. and that's it. And that's why I think most nations have, I think they research probably, and that's probably even died off quite a bit, but that's
yeah,
why most
everyone researches. I mean, I think that's not unusual.
But I think the idea of bioweapons by nation states as an offensive weapon is, I don't think there's any nations that really engage in that because the chances of blowback are so huge. Yeah. And then we talked about, because I think this is really interesting. There was an idea, a theoretical idea, that perhaps you could create a bioweapon that is targeted to genomes, or targeted, think about it ethnically, right? Like, so if you were, if you want to attack Pakistan, you know, you could maybe come up with a bioweapon that is key to something in the genome that Pakistanis have or something. But here's the problem with that. And it's a thing that has long been rumored about, and I think mostly in like the 70s and 80s, but it, you know, it was something that was probably even maybe on the brainstorming sessions in some governments. But here's the problem, is that we're so genetically mixed together as humans, and I think we're finding that out more and more, like as DNA technology, as genetic technology comes more online, and there's, you know, things like you can pay a few bucks and get your genome mapped, and you know, people are finding out really surprising things, like, you know, that their ancestors came from different places than they thought. I mean, there's even those kind of stories where people are finding out their fathers aren't who they thought they were, you know, like
there's a lot. Well, I have two stories, remember. DNA testing has revealed two previously unknown cousins to my mom's side of the family. And everyone was happy about it.
And I had a friend tell me that there a long time ago, there was kind of rumors that the Israelis were, or conspiracy theories that the Israelis were developing genetically targeted weapons to go after the Palestinians. But here's the thing, like, Israelis and Palestinians are almost genetically indistinguishable. They're, you know, they're from the same regions, and there'd be no way to do that. There'd be absolutely
no way.
They're
both, I think the term is Semitic people. So
Semitic.
They're like in the same group. And like you said, we're so intermixed, right? You know, I've seen people post their DNA tests and like, oh my gosh, I'm 3% Middle Eastern. They didn't know that. So, you know, if they develop a weapon after Middle Easterners, you know, they might get a bunch of Europeans, right?
The other thing that was interesting, I read this in an article. There used to be a magazine, I don't think it exists anymore, that was called Covert Action Quarterly. And it was, no kidding, it was a magazine that was published by a bunch of ex-Intel people. And this is for real. It's not a fake. Wow. It wasn't a fake magazine. And they talked about this very thing. And I read this in the 90s. One of the things that they mentioned in the article is that sub-Saharan people, so essentially Africa, they're like the most genetically diverse people on the planet. So it would be impossible, like they'd be the safest if people started making genetically targeted bioweapons. They'd mm-hmm. probably be the safest, because, you know, it'd be impossible to target them. But yeah, I think that's just, bioweapons, I just don't think are a very practical weapon. Now, terrorist organizations, they might have a desire to create this or exploit, pathogens, biological mm-hmm. pathogens. But I honestly think it could backfire on them as well. I mean,
sure. Well, I think the lesson is, like, look at – this thing started in China, right? Like 3 months ago. Yeah. And within 3 months, very short period of time in the scheme of things, it's all over the planet.
Yeah.
So if the terrorists, so-called terrorists, you know, attack Europe or America, It won't take long for that to show up wherever they're from. Like Iran. Yeah. Iran's getting hurt. Really.
Yeah.
So you're right. It's just really, unless you're desperate and stupid, you're not going to do this.
And somehow I don't think terrorist organizations probably have the best lab safety protocols in the world. So
they'd have to have a state sponsor, right? I mean, there's certain things that are so sophisticated, you basically need a big, solid research institution to do
it. Or if you do it on the cheap, it's going to, once again, backfire. I mean, for example, like bomb makers, they all the time, terrorists, like, the various terrorist organizations lose bomb makers because they're building it in, you know, some safe house somewhere and then it's not a lab. It's not a chemistry lab. So they goof up and blow themselves up. That happens all the time.
So we'll go ahead and start wrapping this up. Andy, I sent you a link not too long ago that kind of almost was almost a prediction of sorts, or it was fictional. But and it was an author that you actually were familiar with, Dean Koontz.
Yes.
So what was that book and what was the storyline?
Sure. So Dean Koontz I think he would be classified as a horror writer, but he kind of writes techno horror, if you will. And yeah, I've read a bunch of his books. I've read a lot of his books, particularly years ago when I think in my early 20s, I read quite a few of his books. And apparently, and I have this up on Snopes, and I'll just read it as they frame it. Was coronavirus?
Oh, you have that. Cool.
Yeah, I have it up. I have it up on my phone. Was coronavirus predicted in a 1981 Dean Koontz novel? And they classify this, you know how they classify it as true, mostly false.
On Snopes. Yeah.
On Snopes, yeah. So this is categorized as mostly false, but there's still some interesting details I think that's worth talking about. And they say, what's true? An image shows, this is what's going around the internet, and it's what Greg sent to me. An image shows a genuine page from a Dean Koontz novel, The Eyes of Darkness, containing the words Wuhan 400. And then they say, what's false? Dean Koontz did not predict an outbreak of a new coronavirus. Other than the name, his fictional biological weapon had little in common with the virus that caused a real outbreak in 2020. And one of the things they talk about, I've read it several times, so I can break it down. His version was a bioweapon. And as Greg and I just talked about, this was almost
81. 100%. Yeah. 1981 almost, it was written, right?
Right. 1981. His fictional virus was a bioweapon. And it had 100% fatality.
That's a good weapon.
And it had a 100% transmission, and it took 4 hours to kill you. So just in the real world, that is such a high burn rate that it would never become that big of a deal because everybody who's exposed to it would die very quickly, you know,
before they could pass it along.
Yeah,
and that's somewhat similar to the real thing, Ebola. Ebola was pretty deadly, and that's why it never spread the way that I feared it would, because it kind of burns itself out.
Exactly. And if it began to spread, it would be a less deadly organism. It's kind of a trade-off. It's kind of a balance. So the other thing that's interesting about it is originally in the book that he wrote, in 1981, it was called the Gorky 400, and it originated out of Russia. And at some point, and I have not been able to track down exactly when or why, but certainly around 2008 sometime before 2008, they changed it to be the Wuhan 400. And I haven't really found a good explanation as to why. I believe he's still alive, so maybe I'll do a search to see if he's out there responding to questions about that.
Now, did he name it that because of that research lab? That's
this is just a guess.
Or whoever named it.
This is just a guess, is that Dean Koontz, back when he originally wrote the book in 1981, the Russians were probably the most likely to produce a bioweapon like that. And that's why he called it Gorky, because that's an area in Russia. And And then maybe later on, when he was doing a rewrite, or they were maybe reissuing the book, they took a look at that and went, oh, no, China's doing more bioweapon research or something. It'd be more likely, it would make more sense to a more modern audience to have it come out of China than Russia.
Well, especially Russia. Soviet Union collapsed in 90, so.
Right.
91.
So that's just a guess. That's just a guess as to why that happened.
I think it's kind of not quite fair the way Snopes framed it, because I doubt Kuntz was trying to predict anything. He was writing fiction. Maybe plausible. He was trying to write plausible fiction, but he wasn't predicting anything per se.
Now, there is another thing, apparently, and I believe it was in a 2008 book, the psychic Sylvia Brown did predict. She said there in 2020 there will be a virus that will cause pneumonia-like symptoms and will be deadly. And her prediction was that it would disappear just almost as quickly as it came on, and then it would show up again 10 years later. Now, Sylvia Brown made a lot of predictions. For one thing, she predicted she was going to live to the age of 88, and she died at the age of 77. and she got herself into some trouble because she made predictions about like missing persons and so forth. Her most famous prediction was that she was on one of those talk shows, and there was somebody whose daughter was missing, and they asked her, and she essentially, I've seen the video footage, she essentially says, oh, I'm sorry, sweetie, I'm afraid that your daughter, I'm seeing her now, and she's not alive. And then what happened is the actual missing girl was found years later. She had been, remember that guy who was holding the women in his basement?
Oh, yeah.
That was her. That was her mom. So she was, Sylvia Brown was wrong, you know?
Yeah. And, well, I tend not to lean on psychics too much.
Yeah.
Another interesting kind of coincidence, or maybe she was right sometimes, or who knows, but I mean, wasn't she in the National Enquirer and stuff?
Yeah,
like that?
I think I'm sure she was. She was.
I vaguely remember her. So I mean, even when I was a kid, my parents would joke about the National Enquirer. Oh, so yeah. No, we never took it seriously, but it's interesting that she definitely made that prediction.
She definitely did the rounds of the various talk shows and tabloid, you know, papers and so forth and so on. And that we can end it with that. I do think though, that last thing that we talked about, maybe for a more fun episode, I have kind of thought about, these really interesting coincidences. The one that was, I think, one that's really famous and was in all the books we read as kids, you know, about strange stories or, you know, that those sort of things that we would pick up at the, kids section of the library, is the book that was published about a liner named the Titan that hit an iceberg and sank. And it was published like something like 20 years before the Titanic sank.
Oh, wow. Okay. I think I remember hearing something vaguely like that. So things that kind of do.
Yeah. And I kind of wonder, I mean, just the fun way to look at it is maybe it's retro causality, or maybe there's things that kind of echo down into the past, maybe, you know, and then people put them into, they are inspired and put them into fiction, maybe not even realizing that they're making a prediction.
Well, that will be a fun episode, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So let's wrap this one up, Andy.
All right.
This is episode 35, the COVID ID 19 episode.
Oh God.
And let's hope things get, everyone stay safe, and let's hope this thing, like Sylvia Brown predicted, just goes away. That would be great.
I hope so. Yeah, I, you know, she'll be my hero then.
Okay, everyone, we'll see you guys next time.
All right, take it easy.
All right.
Bye.